تستبشر الملائكة إذا رفع المؤمن صوته بالصلاة على محمد وآل محمد. ولتعجيل ظهور إمام زماننا الثالثة بأعلى.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء وسيد المرسلين وحبيب إله العالمين أبي القاسم محمد. وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المكرمين الغر الميامين، سيما بقية الله في الأراضين وحجته على الخلائق أجمعين، إمام العصر وصاحب الزمان ومحور عالم الإمكان، مهدي هذه الأمة وطاووس أهل الجنة، الحجة ابن الحسن العسكري، فداه أرواح العالمين. اللهم صل على محمد وعلى آله. The world in which we live is governed by a set of laws. These laws govern another set of laws that in turn they take their own part in deciding the consequences of actions. And what happens when, for example, the law of cause and effect, when I talk, there must be an effect of that is a result of that cause. When I breathe, that is a cause. There must be an effect that acts as a consequence of that cause. Now these set of laws that govern the world, the fundamental laws that govern the universe in which we live, they are summarized in four powers and four sources of energy. These four sources of energy include the weak nuclear force, the strong nuclear force, gravity, and the electromagnetic energy. Now they each have their own qualities and attributes and so forth. They each have their own functions in this universe, but generally speaking, the main sources of energy in the entire universe are these four. And this is what made scientists, especially in recent history, in the past few years, scientists have been looking for a formula for something that would unify these four sources of energy and create an explanation for the different phenomenon that we see around us in the world. And this is what has led into many scientists conducting so many different types of research to finally reach a theory that is now commonly referred to as the Grand Unification Theory. A theory, as they call it, of everything. A theory that combines these four sources of energy and provides a common explanation to every phenomenon that we see around us. Some scientists now believe that this grand unification theory is in fact summarized in the string theory, that the world is not composed of particles, but in fact it is composed of strings. Now, this is not the point here. The point I'm trying to make is that all the scientists nowadays, they're actually looking for a theory that would unify all the other theories, that would provide a single explanation to all the phenomenon, which means, in effect, that the entire world, that the entire universe is governed by a single ruler. If we can combine the four sources of energy and provide a common, unified, single explanation for everything that occurs, that means that the person or the entity or the being or whatever it is you want to refer to him as is a single unified body that governs the entire world. Now these four sources of energy, They are by themselves governed by a single law. All the laws in the universe, they in turn are governed by a single law. And that is the law of justice. Without justice, nothing would remain in existence. Without the precise way that these four sources of energy work amongst each other, and in the words of Bill Gates, have a relationship of interoperability. All these laws, all these sources of energy, all these rules that govern the entire universe, they actually work together to make the universe function the way it does. The world in which we live, sometimes you hear people telling you that the world is not perfect, and this is why we have famine and poverty and all sorts of economical, political, and social problems. But the fact is, the world is a perfect place. The world was created to be perfect, and when I say perfect, I don't mean that it was supposed to be, you know, the best, supposed to be comprised of the best of everything. That's not what I mean. What I mean is that it's governed by a set of laws. There is nothing random that occurs in the universe. If you see poverty in the, for example, sub-Saharan African states, if you see problems such as famine, problems such as wars, that's not because the world acts as a random sort of set of occurrences that occur in events. It is because there are things that cause poverty and famine and wars and death and suffering. One of the most common misconceptions, or as they refer to as arguments against the existence of God, is that we see oppression in the world. And if there is oppression, and you claim that God is just, then He doesn't exist. It is either one of two things. Either there is no God, or that your God is not just. He does not exercise justice. And that misconception arises because of a common confusion that occurs between two differing, yet somewhat similar concepts. Between justice and equality. A lot of people confuse these two things. They tell you that there is no justice in the world, and so there is no God, whereas this is a very flawed and invalid argument. It is fallacious by nature. Why? Because justice is defined as doing the right thing at the right time and the right place. That's the meaning of justice. It means giving everyone and everything what they deserve. And that's a very different concept from equality. Equality means everyone is equal. No one is rich, while at the same time we have people who are poor. Everyone needs to be equally rich or equally poor. That, of course, is a very different concept. Let me give you this example. Say if someone walks into this hall, and out of nowhere starts slapping everyone on their faces once. In other words, everyone gets one slap on the face. For no reason whatsoever. Would you call that person just because he slapped everyone equally? Because he slapped everyone once and didn't leave someone unslapped while someone else got slapped 15 times on the face? Would that person be referred to as a just person? The answer is no. Maybe he exercised equality, but not justice. Justice is to slap a person who deserves to be slapped. And to leave someone who doesn't deserve to be slapped. That's justice. It means doing the right thing at the right time in the right place and giving everyone what they deserve. Now, having this in mind, that justice is the foundation of all the other laws and regulations that govern this world. Justice is the basis on which everything else is based on. Having understood that, let's compare, for example, try and apply this concept on the animal kingdom. You see that in the animal world, the strong animals eat the weak animals. The big animals consume the small animals. The animals that consume meat, what they do is that they go around hunting other animals down and eating them. Now, is there injustice in the animal kingdom? Maybe there is no equality, but is there injustice? Can you say that a lion is unjust because he needs to eat the cow, for example? No. Because all of that is a part of the food chain. There is a process in the animal kingdom. There is a hierarchy. There is a process in which the strong animal eats the weak animal, and the strong animal is eaten by the stronger animal. And so on and so forth. There is a chain that needs to be connected. You can't say we should stop all lions from consuming, you know, helpless cats and dogs, for example, because they don't have the ability to defend themselves and the lion just abuses his power, because that's just the way they were created. The animal kingdom is in fact governed by the law of the survival of the fittest. The fittest animals, the strongest animals, the animals with the ability to in fact survive and to adjust themselves to differing climatic changes, for example, those are the animals that survive, and this is why the dinosaurs didn't. This is why they became extinct, because they didn't have the ability to adapt to that new environment they were exposed to. There was an environment without sun, according to, you know, the most common theories. There was no sun, and as a result of that, because the atmosphere was filled with dust, there was no sun, and as a result of that, all the plant life was lost, and as a subsequent result of that, all animals that survived on the eating of plants died off as well, and as a result of that, all the dinosaurs that relied on other animals and plants also became extinct. They were gone. So there is a chain that we call the food chain. Everything's connected. All these rings are connected together. If you take out one ring, if you take out a piece of this chain, you will disrupt the entire environment. You might cause so many disturbances to occur because everything relies on the others. In the human world, however, since we are civilized and understanding and we're equipped with the right tools, we have the power of the intellect, we should live in a very different way, however. The law of the survival of the fittest does not apply or should not apply in the human world. So, in theory, you shouldn't see the powerful consuming the weak and the big taking advantage of the small and for example, the governors and the kings and the queens and the presidents abusing who is under their control and within their kingdoms. That shouldn't happen in theory. Why? Because we humans are equipped with the right tools. Because as human beings, we have the ability to distinguish between right and wrong. As human beings, we were given the greatest favor of all, the power of the intellect, the power to actually distinguish between the good and the bad, the good and evil, what's right and what's wrong. The ability to distinguish between these two ends of the extreme that was given to each and every human being. How? With the power of the intellect. If you go back to the sources of tradition by the commander of our religion, the Holy Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad, as well as the master of believers and their infallible, sinless households, you will notice that all of those books actually start with a section that discusses the meaning of the intellect, or as referred to in the Arabic language as al-aql. Those books, you know, take up the responsibility of telling you about the power of the intellect, to give you a clear definition of the intellect, what is the intellect, and what are the functions attached to the intellect. We're supposed to know, for example, that those who were enemies of the household of the Prophet, those who tried to annihilate Ahlul Bayt, peace and blessings be upon them, they were deprived of the power of the intellect. Not that they didn't know the difference between good and bad. They did know that. But their techniques of deceit and sinister attempts to distort the beautiful image of the Holy Prophet and his household, as we can now see the effects of that sort of, those sorts of attempts in their books, you will, if you actually study the life of the Holy Prophet in certain books that belong to certain denominations, and no need to mention any names, you will find that the Prophet is given a very, very bad image. An image that is sometimes used by those who try to attack Muslims and the religion of Islam to tell you, is this your prophet? Our prophet Jesus Christ was a prophet of mercy. Our prophet Jesus Christ had these great moral virtues and abilities, whereas your prophet is a man who stands up in front of everyone else and urinates. Again, that is nothing but the result of those sinister attempts to distort that beautiful image of the Prophet. So, the human world should be a very different one. The Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Holy Quran, وَإِنَّ لَكُمْ فِي الْأَنْعَامِ لَعِبْرَةً. There exists for you in the cattle and the animals a lesson. Not because animals are superior to human beings. Everybody knows that humans, being equipped with the right tools, having the ability to distinguish between right and wrong, they should be the superior race and the superior creatures on this planet. But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala actually instructs us and teaches us to take a close look at the animal kingdom in order for us to abstain and to keep away from lowering ourselves to the animals. Because sometimes human beings, by not taking advantage of that greatest of all favors given to them, being the intellect and the aql, those human beings actually lower themselves to the level of animals and even lower. As we can read in the Holy Quran, the Almighty Allah says that they are verily like the cattle and the animals. Nay, they are even worse than the animals. Why? Because the animals weren't equipped with these tools. The animals were never bestowed with the favor of the intellect. The animals were never meant to be able to think and make rational judgments. Whereas you were. You were given those tools. You are expected to follow the guidance of the intellect. When you don't, you have in fact lowered yourself to the level of animals and even worse. And this is why sometimes when people abandon the guidance of the intellect, they tend to become even worse than animals. How? Let me ask you this question. If you were sitting here, would you, under normal circumstances, tear off your shirt that you purchased today, that you paid 20 or 30 pounds for? Would you do that under normal circumstances? Hardly think so. Would you slap your friend who is a faithful brother in Islam on the face? I don't think so. Would you, for example, stand up and start screaming? I don't think so. Whereas you, the very same you, would do all those things and even worse if you were, for example, to abandon the power and the guidance of the intellect and to embrace its enemies. What are the enemies of the intellect? Arrogance. Arrogance is one of the enemies of the intellect. It is a soldier on the side of ignorance, as we can see in the traditions of Ahlul Bayt. Ignorance and the intellect are two opposing things. They are leaders that have armies under them. The intellect has its own soldiers to defend the truth, to keep the lantern of truth lit up for us to follow its guidance. And on the other side, you have ignorance. And ignorance has its own soldiers. Those soldiers include arrogance. Those soldiers include the lack of knowledge. Those soldiers include hating someone. Those soldiers include jealousy and envy. When you feel jealousy towards someone, you stop making rational judgments. You cannot use the power of the intellect anymore. And that's why that jealousy develops into a state of hatred between you and the person you are jealous of. And that state of hatred, it might stay in your heart for a while, but then it grows in magnitude until it reaches a point where you simply break the slightest word that comes out from the person you've had jealousy towards could break you and could lead into a great, bloody, ugly brawl between you and that person. And in those circumstances, you do tear your shirt that you purchased today. In those circumstances, you do slap your faithful friend on the face. Under those circumstances, you might get up and scream in front of everybody else, making a fool out of myself in front of my friends. Because the power of the intellect is gone. When that happens, it would be unjust. And I am using my words very carefully here. It would be unjust to call that type of person a human being. Did we not say that justice is doing the right thing at the right time and place and giving everyone what they deserve? A human being without the intellect might look like a human being, but sure as hell doesn't act like one. And that's why a world without the intellect is a world of corruption, a world of injustice, a world of arrogance, a world where people consume each other for no reason whatsoever but to seek the material pleasures of this world. The physical pleasures that stop at a certain point. The physical pleasures that do not continue. Sometimes we sort of run after satisfying our temptations and desires to the point where even when we're fed up, even when we reach the state of satiety and we no longer have the urge to satisfy those desires, we tend to resort to other means to satisfy them over and over again. And this is why they say in the history of the Romans that they used to go out and celebrate and party on these huge feasts. They would take this all types of food and drinks. They would drink it all up. And obviously when you drink, especially when you're hungry, drinking and eating is something that gives you pleasure. That's an obvious thing. Everybody knows that. But what they did is that they'd go one step further. They'd eat and eat and eat, and when they reach the state of satiety, when they're fed up, you know, they no longer can enjoy the food. So what they used to do is that they'd go out, induce vomiting, force themselves to vomit and throw up, then go back to their meals and their feasts. Because we sort of tend to satisfy these desires, and when we're fed up, we sort of, you know, want to continue to party like there's no tomorrow. So let's just do something so I could go straight back to enjoying myself and satisfying my desires and temptations. Such a world is not a human world. It's more like the animal kingdom than a world inhabited by human beings with the guidance of their intellect. This is why you see that in such a world, people go back to the law that governs the human kingdom. Survival of the fittest. In such a world, the strong oppresses the weak. The powerful abuses the small and the one that doesn't have any power and strength and influence and wealth. In such a world, you see people like Alexander the so-called Great. This man who used to go and decimate entire vast tracts of land. He'd go through cities, destroy them, demolish entire cities. And level them with the ground. This man was no human being. He was more like a beast. Now, having believed in that law, survival of the fittest, as he was dying, and he died very young, you know, lucky for everyone living on the planet, he died, I think, before he reached the age of 30, or in his mid-30s, and just as he was dying on his deathbed, they approached him and they said, who's going to succeed you? Will you appoint your own successor? He said, my successor is the strongest. Whoever's strong will succeed me. I'm not going to tell you that it's my son or my favorite general in the army or my brother. No. I'll leave it open. Let's make things more interesting. Whoever can win, that person will have the right to succeed me. That word by Alexander the so-called Great, that caused half a century worth of bloody wars. So many lives were lost because this man believed that the strongest should have the ability and the right to govern and to rule. This person was no human being. You look at, for example, let's just come down and look at our lives as human beings. But even more so, as people who adhere to the religion of Islam, people who believe in the Holy Prophet, people who claim to be lovers of His immaculate, infallible progeny. Let's take a close look at our lives and sort of talk about things in a more frank and open manner. We believe that there is a God. We believe that He had a messenger, and that messenger has successors, and those successors are our leaders. Yet in practice, we sort of tend to make excuses for ourselves. You know, maybe this was never actually decreed. Perhaps this ruling is a controversial one, where there is a great deal of disputes between the scholars. You know, there might have been a scholar who said that this is okay for me to do, even though my scholar says that it's not. But maybe someone disputed that. Who said my scholar was right? Who says my scholar even knows what I'm going through? My scholar lives in a city that doesn't have the same problems, doesn't share the problems that I see in this city and in this part of the world. So he doesn't know what I'm going through. He doesn't know about my problems. Then maybe it's okay for me to do what he tells me that it's not. One of the problems that I have come to know to be spread, especially in our communities, the community of Muslims and the followers of Ahlul Bayt in particular, is the problem of listening to music. And I've been told that this is such a big problem that a lot of us, even religious families and religious people, so-called religious people, they don't pay as much attention to that issue as they should. Well, first of all, once someone asked me whether or not it was permissible to listen to music, and I said I will respond using the response given by Imam al-Sadiq, peace and blessings be upon him, to a man who inquired about the exact same thing. Because it's interesting how so many of the problems faced by us today, you know, 1400 years after the Prophet's migration to the city of Medina, so many of these problems were actually apparent back in that time. It's not like, you know, we have developed, we have evolved and everything. A lot of things have changed. But the basic problems that we face today are exactly the same. Why? Because our needs are exactly the same. We still need to eat and consume food. We still need to satisfy, you know, certain instinctive and basic desires. And so most of these problems were common back then. You know, don't think this is something new that the imams, for example, didn't address. No, everything in Islam has been addressed. Islam is an all-encompassing religion. A religion, and I've said this over and over again, and I'd have to repeat it because it's such an important thing for us to understand. Islam is a religion where our scholars, namely Samahat Ayatullah al-Uzma, المرحوم السيد محمد الشيرازي على الله تعالى مقامه الشريف. This man's written an entire encyclopedia of jurisprudence and on Islam. And this encyclopedia isn't, you know, one or two books. And I really would recommend you each start writing a book for you to know the significance and the difficulty in writing such a great number of books. And in that encyclopedia, he has books that address the issue of traffic control using sources from the main sources of jurisprudence, namely the Holy Quran and the traditions of Ahlul Bayt. Traffic control in Islam. The environment and how it should be preserved and treated in Islam. Cooking in Islam. And things that don't even cross our minds have been addressed in this great religion of ours. Now, Islam says that, you know, this is permissible and that's not permissible. Obviously, believing in the Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala being a just God, we know for sure that what He is telling us right here is true. And the response, back to the response of Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, he says to the man, he says, if you had two categories, if you were to make two lists, and you would write down the items that you thought using your intellect were permissible in Islam in the first list, and you would write down the items that are not permissible in Islam in the second list. Where would music be? And the man, again, was guided by the guidance of his intellect, the built-in knowledge that he has, the read-only memory, as we see in computer systems. They have this ROM that includes the basic information that the computer needs to start up. Now, we have that ROM built into us. We have the intellect that tells us this is right and that's wrong. Where would music be? It would be on the list, as the man replied to Imam al-Sadiq, in the list of the non-permissible acts, the things that I'm not supposed to be doing. And another response would be, would you ever imagine the likes of the Holy Prophet of Islam, or the Commander of the Faithful, or the successive leaders, the Imam, peace and blessings be upon them, could you ever imagine any of them sitting down, listening to, you know, the latest album of Christina Aguilera, or Anastasia, or, you know, Britney Spears, or Shakira, or the likes of these people, that I really don't like to mention their names, but it's so that we would understand these are two distinct categories of people. On one side, you have the infallible leaders that we should follow. On the other side, you have the likes of these filthy so-called human beings that all they think about, all they seek is the satisfaction of their own desires. And we tend to push ourselves in the fires of hell trying to imitate them and follow them and listen to them. What do they have to tell us? What is it that we learn by listening to the likes of these human beings? Now, I had another lecture today, and one of the young people approached me at the end and he said, "We have a great problem at this school." I said, "What, you want to overthrow the principal? Get rid of him? Because nobody seems to like the principal." He said, "No, that's not the problem. The problem is that a lot of us listen to music. A lot of these kids, you know, even supposedly religious children, they listen to music because their parents don't tell them that this is wrong." Well, my response as I was leaving, I didn't have much time to discuss the issue. I just told him one thing, and I want you to listen carefully. I told him, ask those children, ask those young people, ask the youth, ask the elderly, ask everyone that you feel has the problem, the addiction to listening to music. Ask him this question: do you love the Commander of the Faithful and the Master of Believers, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace and blessings be upon him? I'm sure that they won't say no. They'll say, of course we love him. We're followers of his faith. The next question: if you really love him, then listen to his tradition. He says that whose heart shakes by listening, and this is a literal translation, that whose heart shakes by the listening to the sound made by musical instruments has slapped Ali ibn Abi Talib on the face. Would you ever slap your master on the face? Would you ever even think and contemplate the idea of slapping him on his face? I hardly think so. No one would have the nerve to do such a thing. Now that is just as bad. And let me tell you just one effect by music. A few scientists, I think about 3-4 years ago, conducted a research. What they did was they went to clubs where there is an abundance of music and dancing and so forth, you know, places specifically and primarily erected in the name of committing sins. Places where no human being should go into, much less people who adhere to the religion of Islam. Now what they did was, they went to the gates of these so-called, you know, places of entertainment, these clubs, and they would take a sample from the women that entered those clubs. They would take a sample of their blood, and from that sample of blood, they would measure the amount of the hormone estrogen, the female hormone, which obviously is an indication of so many different things. One of the things that the increase or the decrease in the female hormone estrogen refers to is the sexual desire of that woman. The more estrogen, the more libido and the more tendency that the woman will commit sins by trying to satisfy her desire. They would take those samples, let the women in. Once they left the clubs, they would take another sample of their blood and count the level of estrogen again. And they found that the level of estrogen, the female hormone, actually increased by 30%. That was the average. Which means that music, my friends, isn't only forbidden by God and the only consequence being the fires of hell. Just as you were to slap the commander of the faithful on his face, that's not the only consequence. The other consequences include the increase in the temptations and desires that have no other... I mean, there's absolutely nothing you can do to block those desires and temptations once they rise to that level, but to try to satisfy them. And that is why we have so many other problems in society. I let my kids listen to music thinking that they're innocent children who don't have the power to tell the good from the bad, children who don't need to pray or fast, and so they might as well listen to music. We think that this does not leave an adverse effect on our children, yet it does. This is not only proven by the traditions of Ahlul Bayt, but also recent scientific research conducted by people who don't even believe in God or the Prophet of Islam. They found out that music had that effect on their level of hormones, which could lead to other complications and other problems. When we as human beings abandon the power of the intellect and we opt to satisfy those desires, they could be the libido, they could be things like our arrogance, they could be things like the hatred that we hold in our hearts towards our fellow Muslim brothers and sisters. When we opt for that option, we lose control. And that's why in the traditions of Ahlul Bayt, we have teachings that if someone gets angry, because they have the tendency to do things that they would normally not do in public, get them to sit down. In other words, change the mood. Try and change the mood. Or recite the adhan in their right ear. Remind them of the Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and their religion. If they're sitting down, get them to stand up. Just try and change the atmosphere. Because that way you might get the person to come back to his intellect and his rational thinking. Otherwise they could do things that they would never do in public under normal circumstances. I have a friend who had this problem. He'd come up to me and say, "Sayyid, sometimes I get angry with people." And what's even worse than the original problem is that the person gets angry for no reason. He says, "I'm walking and I see someone looking at me and I get infuriated. I simply want to kill the man. Why? I don't know." He says, "I go up to the person and from then on I don't remember anything. 5-10 minutes later, when I come back to, you know, my old self, I look down and I see blood. I see blood on my hands. I see the person bruised all over, broken, you know, bones, and the person being taken inside an ambulance and towards the hospital. And I didn't even know what I did." And his brother used to make fun of him. He used to say, you know, he'd fight and then after the fight he'd go, "Who stuck that pencil up that person's eye?" You know, he doesn't know what he did. He actually told me, he told me that I simply black out. I don't see anything anymore. That's why you've been told, try and control your emotions. Try and stay rational. Try and think before every step that you take. Don't just go around, you know, joining the army of ignorance and going with the flow and doing things that you would normally not do. This is why you see people who have abandoned the intellect. People like, there's actually an author by the name of Montesquieu. He's French and he was a very high ranking scholar. He's written a book, he's written several books. His masterpiece is a book named The Spirit of the Laws. In that book he sort of discusses the philosophies behind the laws enacted in European countries and the history of lawmaking in Europe. The book was written I think around 300 years ago. The incident he mentions occurred 450 years ago, according to my calculations. He says in that book that 450 years ago, in Sweden, which was a very so-called civilized country, and up until today, the Swedish people actually consider themselves very civilized, very understanding, way ahead of everybody else. Now, 450 years ago, in Sweden, they had the system of slavery and, you know, masters with so many slaves under their control. Now, he says in the book that if a master was killed, if a person, a noble person, so-called noble person who has slaves under his control, if he was killed, then they would kill all of his male as well as female slaves. If he had 30, 40, 50, 200 slaves, they would all be slaughtered. Why? Because their master was killed. Even if they didn't kill him. They kill them all. And then not only that, they'd get someone to go on top of his house, the deceased house, and he would cry out in the loudest possible voice in four directions. Then they would go send people to stand out, you know, outside the house and sort of calculate the distance that the voice traveled. For example, if the person crying out made his voice, you know, up to a certain distance, say a kilometer in the, around the vicinity of that house, they would take all the slaves, male as well as female, in that entire perimeter, and they would slaughter them to honor the blood of one master, one noble person who was killed. No more intellect, no more thinking, no more rationale, nothing. Nothing, sheer animal mentality. Killing everyone off? Now, take a look at Islam. Go back, not 450 years ago. Go back 600 years, 700, 800, 900 years ago. Our scholars enacted the laws of Islam. 1,000 years ago, scholars such as Sheikh al-Saduq, may God be pleased with them, they wrote down the Islamic constitution, the laws of Islam. And in those laws, you see teachings for the judges, for example, who need to treat the people, their clients, the defendants and those who have a complaint, to treat them equally. Not even look at one person more than looking at the other person. This is the beauty of Islam. Take a look at our role models and our leaders, such as Imam Ali, peace and blessings be upon him. You know, I was once at a church and they asked me about Islam and certain issues. It's a long story, but the point is, I started telling them these stories of the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam, and they were amazed. And there were a few priests and many Roman Catholic, as well as... take a look at Imam Ali, for example. He is the leader of 50 of today's nations, 50 countries. And back then, this was two-thirds of the world as they knew it. And he is standing in the mosque, leading the congregational prayers. Imagine if an emperor or a king or a president that has 50 nations under his control, I don't know how many people would be following him in his prayers, but they'd be in the thousands. No doubt about it. You know, just imagine 20,000 people following Imam Ali's leadership in that prayer. And he is just about to enter the state of Ihram and start his prayers, but just before he does that, a small, weak, old woman walks into the mosque. She says, "Oh, Ya Amir al-Mu'mineen, I have a complaint." فَانْفَلَتَ مِنْ صَلَاتِ. He stopped the prayer, he sat down. He didn't say, go fill out a complaints form and throw it in the complaints box, we'll take a look at it in the next board meeting. He simply sat down. "What do you have to say? I'm at your service." He sits down. The woman comes up to him. She says, "I have a complaint." "What is it?" "I come from the province, one of the southern provinces of Iran. And the local governor appointed by yourself, O commander of the faithful." "All right. What would you imagine to be the problem here? It must be a really big problem. Otherwise, she wouldn't disrupt this huge congregation of prayer to come and talk to the commander of the faithful. And he wouldn't stop praying unless it was something really important. Do you know what it was? She says, the governor, he didn't oppress us. He doesn't, for example, throw us in jail and incarcerate us. He doesn't, kill our children and imprison our husbands. Do you know what he does? He pressurizes us. He places pressure on us to pay taxes. Tell this to today's politicians. Tell this to the so-called civilized governments of the time. He puts pressure on us. I feel so sorry for her. To force us into paying the legal religious taxes. And we're not talking about extra taxes imposed that were later imposed by the subsequent khulafa. No, we're talking about khums and zakat, things that they had to pay anyway. It was a religious obligation for them to pay those taxes. She says, the man puts too much pressure on us. Do you know what he does, Imam Ali? Immediately, without a pause, he calls for a piece of paper and something with which he could write. He writes his letter of dismissal to that governor. You are fired. How dare you put pressure on my citizens to pay taxes? If they want to pay taxes, they do it themselves. Why do you pressure them into paying those taxes? Leave them alone. This is my country, and in my country, freedom and justice prevails. He looks at another man who's walking in the streets of Kufa, and he's begging, an elderly man. And he asks his companions, who is this man? Why is there someone under my jurisdiction, a citizen of my country, having to beg on the streets? Why is he begging? They tell him, oh, Amir al-Mu'mineen, he's nothing but a Christian man. You know, leave him alone. He's not even a Muslim. He doesn't deserve to be helped. He says, you used up his power when he was young. We used him for labor when he was young. And now when he's old and he no longer has the ability to continue working, you leave him begging on the streets? Assign a monthly wage for him from the monetary fund. He gets a monthly wage. He gets an income assigned to him by the commander of the faithful. And I once told this to a group of Christians as well. I said, the system of superannuation was invented by Imam Ali alayhi salam. It was invented by us Muslims. So don't think you're civilized now thinking that, you know, you live in wealthy countries and so you're better than us. We invented all these systems of justice. We were the first people to implement it at a time when Christians and Jews and those living in the Western world were nothing but mere pirates, stealing for food, killing for food, and killing for nothing but the satisfaction of their desires to kill, as some of them continue to do so. Now, Islam was the first system and the most perfect system to implement justice. So isn't it sad, isn't it absolutely outrageous that the Prophet himself had to endure and suffer from injustice? But not only him, his entire household, his progeny, his kindred, they all had to suffer injustice to the extent that not one of his household, not a single member of that house died out of natural causes. They were all killed, either by poison or by the sword. But after all of that, having known all of that, لا يومك يوم الحسين لا يومك يومك يا أبا عبد الله. And this is why I oppose the widespread quote that sometimes is brought up, that there is no, every day is Ashura and every land is Karbala. That is wrong. It is wrong not only because it doesn't give the required meaning, but because it contradicts clear traditions by Ahlul Bayt that there is no day like the day of Ashura, no land like the land of Karbala. There is no day like the day of Hussein. And in a day like this, Imam Zain al-Abidin, the son of Abi Abdullah al-Hussein, comes back to the land of Karbala, to the plains of that city on which the blood, the holiest blood, was shed. He comes back. Why? Because the bodies were left there on the plains of Karbala. And there were people that had tried to bury those bodies, but they couldn't do so. Do you know why? Because the bodies were all decapitated. Because the bodies were severed from their heads. Because the bodies were unidentifiable. Because they didn't have any way to find whose body belonged to which head. And that's why Imam Zain al-Abidin had to come back to take care of that situation, because he knew his father. He saw it all happen. This is the place where my father was stabbed on the back with a spade. This is the place where my father was hit on the forehead with a rock. This is the place where my uncle Abbas was hit in his eye with an arrow. An arrow which was planted in his eye. An arrow which could not be removed from his eye because it had penetrated so deep into his skull. This is the place where my brother Ali ibn al-Asghar was slaughtered from the jugular vein to the jugular vein. This is where they were all killed. And these are their bodies. This is their head. This is my father. This is my uncle. He goes there. He picks up. He tries to pick up the body of his beloved father, Imam al-Hussein. He picks up one piece, but the other one falls. He picks up another piece and the third one falls. He picks them all up and he takes them to his final resting place, his grave. He puts them in there. But Imam Zain al-Abidin, he had been in that journey. He had seen what he had seen, what no one else had the ability to actually be patient with. But he had no one to complain to. He had no one to converse to. He had no one to tell him what he saw, except for his grandfather, except for his mother Fatima al-Zahra, his father Amir al-Mu'mineen, and his uncles who were also deceased by that time. He would talk to his grandfather and tell him, "O Prophet of Allah, they killed my father, they killed my uncles, they killed my brothers." يعز على يا رسول الله أن تسبى نساه إلى يزيد الطايا ويرى وهو قرة عينه ورجاله لن تبقى منهم باقيا وجسمهم تحت السنابك بالعراء ورأسهم فوق الرماء حي العالية لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم إنا لله وإنا إليه راجعون اللهم إنا نسألك وندعوك باسمك العظيم الأعظم الأعز الأجل الأكرم يا الله 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 اللهم عجل لوليك الفرج والعافية والنصر اللهم اجعلنا من أصحابه وأعوانه وشيعته ومحبيه والذابين عنه والممتثلين لأوامره ونواهيه اللهم وارزقنا الشهادة في سبيلك وبين يديه وتحت لوائه يا الله اللهم كل وليك الحجة ابن الحسن صلواتك عليه وعلى آبائه وتمتعه فيها طويلا. اللهم اخض حوائجنا يا الله. اللهم أعدنا إلى أوطاننا سالمين إلى سالمين. اللهم أد ديوننا، شاف مرضانا بحق مريض كربلاء زين العابدين. اللهم ارحم موتانا، خاصة سماحة آية الله العظمى الإمام السيد محمد الشيرازي. اللهم تغمده بواسع رحمتك وأسكنه فسيح جناتك مع من يتولى محمد وآل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. وإلى أمواتنا نهدي جميعا ثواب سورة الفاتحة مع الصلوات.